And I want to talk a little bit more about artificial selection and all these covariance rules. And then, leasing through, yeah, what we had, you'll recall, was that R.A. Fisher, by this rather magical method, had imagined partitioning the genotype into additive contributions from the individual copies. Those are called additive effects. Pairwise interactions among the two copies at a locus. Those are called dominance deviations. And then an environmental effect. And then worked out the formulas for the covariance of two relatives, namely a fraction F1 of the additive variance plus a fraction F2 of the dominance variance, where F1 is the probability that a single copy you find contributing, say, to my phenotype also shows up identical by descent in my relative. I should say that I'm going to go from here to talk about artificial selection for a while. While we don't have a full class session, we'll probably finish a little early. And so then after that, if you have questions about the quantitative genetic material, that would be a good time to ask them, or questions about really anything in the course. But right now, let's get through the artificial selection stuff, which is one of the great applications of quantitative genetics. So you have these formulas in terms of these mysterious quantities V sub A, the additive genetic variance, and V sub D, the dominance genetic variance. And for example, for parent offspring covariance, it's a half the additive variance. And as an aside, I mentioned that people are accustomed to calling the fraction of all the variance that is in this first term V sub A, the heritability, and that's a number between 0 and 1, gives you a feel for some of the genetic variability, although it's not a measure of the total fraction of all variability that's genetic. That would involve V sub D, but it's not up here in the numerator. Okay. Anyway, where are we headed? Fisher, by doing all this, takes a bunch of things you don't know. How many loci are involved, what kinds of interactions they have with each other, how big their effects are, what alleles are present and what frequencies, all of that you don't know for a typical quantitative character. It's becoming knowable for the genes that make largest contributions using genome-wide association studies and other methods, other genomic methods, but even then it's still accounting for very little of the variation of most characters. Assuming you don't have that, what Fisher's rules do give you is a whole bunch of different covariances, including the covariance of an individual with itself, which is just its variance. Those quantities are all predicted in terms of three numbers, V sub A, V sub D, and V sub E, so you can fit to empirical data, and you can make estimates of them. And now we're going to apply that to what happens if you impose artificial selection on the trait. And of course, that's something that animal and plant breeders have been doing since there was agriculture, breeding, for example, from the top part of their herd and seeing changes. And all of the virtually all the animals that we consume in one sense or another, and certainly all the plants, are extensively bred. We have in our backyard, for example, silly example, a tree that when I was a kid we used to call these crab apples, tiny little basically indigestible bitter apples, but the tree is cultivated for as an ornamental. Well, basically what those are, that's what an apple looked like before modern agriculture got a hold of it, before even before traditional plant breeding got a hold of it and turned it into this big juicy thing that we eat now. So people have been doing this for years. What this theory does is take these variance components and make a prediction as to how much response there will be to one generation of artificial selection. And the way it does it is very much connected to the issue of what the covariance between parents and offspring is. Here is a plot of offspring against parents. This is an imaginary simulated example, but I simulated the noise into it. And so there you have pairs of parents and offspring. And they're plotted, and they make what happened? Did you lean against it?
I think I might have knocked it.
Okay, push the top button again. If it's entirely black, push the top left button. Anyway, I'll talk about it, but it's not. Yeah, it's shutting down. It's shutting down a lot. We have to wait till it gets happy. This is a very sensitive machine that gets upset very easily. And actually, push this button so that one will shut down. It's not even on. Once it finishes shutting down, finishes going up and down, it is your moral responsibility to be the one who pushes the button, and it'll come back on. Then it's going to warm up and decide whether it's happy with the projector, with the computer. When the first generation of classroom projectors were incredibly cranky, if you turned the computer on before the projector, you were wrong and you couldn't project. Or go into a different classroom, if you turned the projector on before you turned the computer on, you were wrong in that case. And so we were always wrong, and we it always wouldn't project. This one's a sort of generation 1.5, and it's still very cranky. I think newer projectors just come on and show you the projection. What is it saying now? It says it's on. It is not, okay, it is flickering, sort of, making flickering noises. Let me make sure. I don't want to have to go upstairs and get our lab projector. Okay, we're going to use the high-tech device in the middle of the table I don't know if this will do anything, actually. This is much more fun than the actual lecture, yeah. I don't know how to make this do anything, but I do know how to use a stick. You poke it. It's blinking now. One of these should be the one where one pokes it. I think that was showing green. Yeah, now it came on. The stick works. This is an earlier version of a laser pointer. Okay. All right, now it has to decide that it's happening. Okay. So what we'll have here is the parent-offspring, the graph of parents and offspring. And you can imagine that as you look at it, there we go, you see the regression line. That's the least squares line. Well, that's the predicted least squares line. I think that, let me just check. Yeah, no. Go back here. Yeah. And what this means, this is a bivariate normal distribution, a two-variable distribution of two things, each of which is normally distributed. They're covarying with each other in a bivariate normal distribution. The slope is expected to be the covariance of the traits of the relatives divided by the variance of the horizontal axis. And if you look at it, the covariance is a half the additive variance, and the variance is additive plus dominance plus environmental variance. So if you look back at the heritability formula, you'll see that that's half the heritability. So the slope of parents and offspring should be half the heritability. Now, the interesting fact, the one that we'll make use of, is that if I take any particular value here, I say take all those parents who are 9.6 in their value, and I go up here and I look at the conditional distribution of everybody. What about the offspring of only those parents whose value is 9.6? Well, that's a tiny thin slice of this distribution. The interesting fact for bivariate normal distributions is that if you cut through, the conditional distribution is normal. Surprise, surprise. And what is its mean? Well, its mean will turn out to rest exactly on this regression line. Now, I have to say that real quantitative characters are not quite normally distributed. They're the sums in the Fisherian type of model. They're the sums of random discrete quantities, but maybe quite a few of them, plus an environmental noise. That won't quite be normal, but it will be pretty close to. So this is an approximation, but not a bad one. Now we say to ourselves, okay, I'm the breeder, and I want to breed this animal or plant by taking only those parents that are above a certain cutoff. I'm going to breed from the top of the herd. If I do that, if I breed from parents here that are right here at 11.8, let's say, then what offspring will they give me? Well, the offspring will be in a normal distribution, sliced through vertically here. Its mean will rest on the regression line. So on average, the average mean of the offspring will be this value. Here's the population mean, 10. And 10, horizontally, also the mean of the offspring. So parents who are this far above the population mean give offspring that are not nearly so far above the population mean. They regress back towards the parent value, the mean value of the population, and that word regress is the usage that Galton made in the 1880s when he defined the coefficient of regression. So this is breeding from one parent, say taking offspring of males and then having a random female mate and looking at the offspring. So you're selecting only on one of the two sexes. So the what will the average response be? Well, now we have to just consider that we're going to select, let's have a selection cutoff, let's say at 11 here, and we're going to breed only from those individuals that are 11 and up. They will be a series of these slices, each one of which will give you a response, the lowest of which will give you a response up to this value, and then as you move further right, they give you more and more response. Now, since the average response is a simple linear function of where the parent is, it follows that if I take all the selected individuals and consider their mean, so this is the average of the ones you're breeding from, they're above the population mean, they will have an average. This average is here on the red line, and the difference between that and the population mean is called the selection differential. So we're saying we're breeding from those. In this case, they might be 11.6 and the mean is 10. That means the selection differential is 1.6 of whatever unit this is, like kilograms or something, of whatever character we're measuring. So the selection differential is this horizontal purple arrow. The what's the mean of all the offspring? It'll turn out to be each individual numerical value here has an offspring, predicts an offspring mean by bouncing off the line. Because of the linearity of all that, it turns out that the overall selection response will just be if you took the mean of the selected individuals and bounced off the line. So what is it? It's half the heritability times the selection differential. It's this difference times, and it's the rise you would get out of going that far out, and that's simply the slope times this horizontal value. So it's the selection differential times the slope, and slope is half the heritability. But that's selecting on one parent. If you're dealing with a trait in which you can select on both parents, you'll get twice as much selection response. That requires a little hand waving. Here is the rule, the resulting rule for selecting on both parents, breeding only from those parents who are both, where both the male and the female are have this are beyond the cutoff. And this is called the breeder's equation. It's a simple product. The response to selection in one generation is equal to the heritability times the selection differential. So it's a very simple rule. Now, that's if the selection is on both sexes of the parent. That's not always reasonable. Suppose, now, and things get very tricky. Suppose, for example, somebody might say, we're going to have dairy cattle. We want to select the dairy cattle for, let's say, milk yield. There's other things you can select for, like butter fat level, for example. But let's say you want to select for milk yield. Well, you can't select on both parents because only the females have milk yield. So what do you select on? You might say, well, of course, the females. Nope, the males. Why? How could you select on males that don't produce milk? The answer is, as a practical matter with dairy cattle, the females can be measured for their milk yield, but selecting female cattle and breeding offspring from them is a very slow, tedious process. Much better to select by selecting the sperm in using artificial insemination, and basically by going out and buying a test tube of frozen sperm. And that can be used to fertilize many, many females. And so you end up with this quantitative genetic theory that involves inferring the variance components and predicting the selection response. It starts to get very tricky because you have to consider, this is a classical problem called the bull index problem. You have a bull, do you want to use sperm from that bull? Well, first you have to test mate the bull, have the offspring with a number of females, have the offspring grow up, measure the milk yield of the offspring. Now that can take a while. On the other hand, even if the bull has meanwhile died, it's okay, you've got their sperm in the freezer. And then one does all kinds of indirect calculations to figure out how good is this sperm based on the number of times it's been tried, given that that's a noisy process. And often the sperm will be rated more highly if it has been tested many times, even though its average, the average performance of the offspring isn't quite as great. So there's all this statistics, multivariate statistics goes in, and you end up, in this case, you're selecting based on the performance of relatives of the individual you're selecting on. And it gets even worse. In corn, in hybrid corn, you grow two inbred strains of corn. Well, you grow two strains of corn, you do a cross between them. The hybrids are the corn seed that you're going to sell, and their performance is what you're breeding for. So you end up breeding in two lines, say a male parent line and a female parent line, selecting individuals based not on their phenotype, but on the phenotype of a cross between the lines. That's called reciprocal recurrent selection. And again, there's many papers been written on how to do that properly statistically. The whole industry of modern quantitative genetics-based animal breeding and plant breeding is a relatively recent occurrence. The guy who was critical to all of this was Jay Lush, who about 1929, attended lectures by Sewell Wright at the University of Chicago and assimilated Sewell Wright's views, which were similar to R.A. Fisher's, about how you think about variance components. And Jay Lush then went off and started his job at in the animal breeding operation at Iowa State University. And he wrote a book in about 1937. This is an image of one of the early editions. You can actually find the PDF of the book online easily. And it basically said, look, folks, here's how you do this estimation of variance components. Here's how you use it in deciding what the response to selection is going to be, so that you can plan out how strongly to select and how much response you're going to get. And it goes beyond that. You have selection on indices of multiple characters. That's called index selection. So you have family selection, index selection, reciprocal recurrent selection, etc. In writing this book, this became enormously influential for quantitative genetics-based animal breeders and also plant breeders. Lush went on to train a generation of professors of quantitative genetics in animal breeding and plant breeding departments, not only in the US but internationally. He became very well known, and he trained all sorts of people in the field. And what you have to realize is that the use of this quantitative genetic approach superseded an older tradition of show ring breeders. People, there were great professors of animal and plant of animal and plant breeding, and what they would do is go out and look for beautiful animals. So they would go out, and the farmer would say, look at this cow, isn't it great? And the professor would say, wow, in my expertise, I can tell you that's a wonderful cow, breed from it. That kind of approach has some merit, but not much. By the way, it is the theory behind all these 4-H club projects, where people are always, used to hear a lot about them, you hear less now. People are always breeding beautiful cattle and presenting them at the state fair, and everyone says, that's the most beautiful cow I've ever seen. Must be wonderful. In fact, that's been superseded by a quantitative genetics, more statistical approach to animal and plant breeding. Now, in the current era, from about the 1990s on, everyone in quantitative, in plant and animal breeding, is foaming at the mouth about SNP chips and genome sequencing. Nevertheless, the number of the success of that is still very limited, and that's indicated very well in human, in, for example, accounting, finding genes accounting for like human height, where many genes have been found that have an effect on human height. But the total variance that's been explained, well, last I heard was around 15%. Maybe it's gone up as high as 20%. It's not much higher than that. So most of the genes of contributing variance to a trait like human height have not yet been found. And the genomics approach holds great promise for the future, but as it develops, we'll still need, in order to do a good statistical analysis, we will still need this variance components theory of Fisher. A few years ago, I used to think, well, maybe I shouldn't teach this anymore. Genomics is coming and sweeping all this away. I need not have worried. It's still anyone doing a serious statistical analysis of quantitative traits is still going to have to use the old-fashioned Fisher variance components approach and the breeder's equation to predict response to artificial selection. I should say that there is also, under the rubric of evolutionary quantitative genetics, a series of equations involving slopes of fitness curves against quantitative characters that were put out, that were developed in the 1980s by Russell Landy, who's now in Norway, at the University of Norway, And he developed in the 1980s forms of the Breeder's equation that were more meaningful to people estimating fitness surfaces in natural populations, where you weren't selecting by just taking the top of the herd, but natural selection was giving an advantage to, for example, certain traits that were near an optimum. And there's a whole lot of activity on that. In fact, Stephen Arnold of Oregon State University and I have been running a course, a week-long course on evolutionary quantitative genetics, a non-credit summer course. This year it's occurring at Friday Harbor here in the first week of June. Admissions are already closed, so it's not something you can sign up for this year, nor is it free. But anyway, there's a lot of interest among people working on quantitatively measurable traits in natural populations in using these extensions, the sort of Russlandy extensions of the quantitative genetics machinery from animal and plant breeding. I think I'm going to stop there, but I think I should give you a chance to ask any questions concerning quantitative character machinery and or other questions. Come on, I gave you a 20-minute warning that I was going to ask questions. That's only fair. I mean, the great advantage of the Fisher quantitative genetics approach is that you get these things you can measure. And you don't have to know how many loci, how many alleles, whether the alleles have big or small effects, what kinds of interactions there are. You can do these, you can relate these observables to each other. That's the advantage. The disadvantage is you don't have to know about the genes, means you can't find out about the genes. That just looking at the covariances among relatives, those traits could be the result of 5 loci, or they could be the result of 500 loci. And you have no idea where the loci are from any of that. Now you start correlating that with SNP chip observations, there are huge statistical problems, but at least there's some hope of getting down to the gene level that way. So your assignment in the next 2 minutes is to think of a question and ask it. All right, you raised your hand.
Okay, it's probably a stupid question, but if you were to compare isogenic populations and...
What's isogenic? The class doesn't necessarily what isogenic means.
So like if you had a population of flies or something that was all the same genotype.
Yeah.
And you used Fisher's analysis of variation and then looked at the covariance.
So you have a totally inbred.
Yes.
A totally inbred strain. Yeah, this all works, but it doesn't tell you anything very interesting. Because what it tells you is that when you get the covariances of relatives within an inbred strain, it's zero for all relatives. The estimates of the additive and dominance genetics variances are zero.
Is there a way to isolate?
And then the selection response will also be zero. So it tells you the right answer, but the right answer means that you're not getting at V sub A and V sub D.
But if you wanted to use that strategy to, say, isolate an environmental response of spread or something.
Well, if you, for example, it is extremely common in all kinds of experimental biology to use inbred strains, and that's precisely so that you don't have to worry about the genetic variation contaminating what you're looking at, which is usually something else. You know, the effect of a drug on some phenotype.
It's a silly question, but I'm wondering if it's a way that you can. A strategy you could use to study what variation that is non-genetic, basically.
Well, then that's in a sense what the entire biomedical you know, everybody working with inbred strains of organisms in biomedical concerns is doing. It also means they don't really use the Fisher stuff because all the variance components are zero anyway if you've got inbred strains, and that's the objective. You could, in principle, breed different genotypes, make inbred strains with different genotypes. That's not so easy. And then look at the differences of means of those and attribute genotypes, phenotypes to genotypes, and look at the genetic effects that way. That started to be done even in the 1950s and 60s. There was a guy named John Foday, professor of genetics at Cambridge University, who used to do that with flies. Now, but what he was trying to do was basically genomics before there was genomics, using he was using visible morphological markers in fruit flies, and then trying to attribute variation in outbred populations to different regions of the chromosome. Now we can do it in a much more extensive way, but it still is not yet yielding. There aren't very many traits on which we can say where 80% of the variation comes from genetically. Mostly we're down in the 10, 15, 20% range at best. Before you ask any other questions here? Try again, okay.
Okay, so you talked about this guy in the 80s who made the outbred lines to find loci responsible.
John Foday in the 50s and 60s, yeah.
So could you do something like that, similar, but instead what you're trying to use Fisher's strategy not to look at genetic variation, but how the response to an environmental component of variation changes in a different genotype.
Yeah,
so
that's
what the guy in the 80s did, but you're not...
In the 50s and 60s.
You
can, the model I've presented, the genes simply add something to the trait, and then the environment adds something. If there's interaction between which genotype you have causes what kind of environmental effect, that's called genotype by environment interaction. And there's also a concept of genotype by environment covariation, where if the genotypes in certain environments also tend to be different, then it becomes a little harder to say what's due to genotype and what's due to environment. But yeah, that's a whole area of investigation. And in the model that I presented here, it was ruled out by simple assumptions.
Right.
I think I've come to the end, and thank you, and we will not resume on Monday. People should turn in their homeworks, I hope, by the end of the day. I will mail them to you. Remember to put your address on. I'll mail them to you, mostly at campus box numbers, and the paper will have written on it the score for that paper, the total score for the course, and your grade. And I'll also be posting a distribution of grades on the website, which will still be there. So, end of course. Thank you.